The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. As promised, David, you've returned from Shanghai with some information about the gold market. And for the listener who's just now tuning in who maybe owns gold and is saying, oh, what are we looking at China for? I think the main reason we're looking at China is U.S. demand for gold is about 5% of the market. In China, what's the demand relative to the United States for gold in China?
Right. When looking at the physical gold market, the U.S. accounts for 6% of total global demand, and China and India combined are over 50%. What we're witnessing is a rapid revolution or even evolution in the controlling interests of the metals market, and it's very evident that the handoff from the UK markets to the US markets is being repeated again here in history, with the baton being passed to China.
So what you're saying,
as we witness it now.
England used to be the place, London was the place that controlled the gold price and the demand, and then it was handed off to the United States for 60 years maybe?
Yeah, and volumes in London are still the highest in the world, but you could say between London and New York, they are the controlling interest. I think when I look at the role that gold has played in our economy, I'm thinking also not just of the quantities and volumes, but the implication of the gold holdings and what that enabled the underlying economy to become and develop into. So you had the greatest economy in the world, the British economy, and that baton was passed, along with sort of the gold standard from the pound sterling to the U.S. dollar. And as our currency gained legitimacy and credibility, so did our economy grow and expand in terms of its international reach and importance. And I think we're seeing that, too, in China. You know, we've had investor demand here in the West, which has been very fickle, particularly this year starting in April. And the East will end up dominating the gold market within 36 to 48 months, and they will become not just the price takers that they are today, buying on cheaper prices, but the price makers of the gold market on that kind of a time frame.
Well, and we talked a few weeks ago how you and your dad were there in China, very similar to why your dad was in South Africa years ago, when South Africa was the dominant player as far as production of gold. But, you know, meeting with the World Gold Council's Albert Cheng, that was an important meeting for you because he is the representative for the World Gold Council in China, and that really is where the action is in gold right now.
Well, and he covers all of Asia. He'll be our guest on the commentary here in a few weeks, and you want to make sure and listen in for that. But, you know, some of the things that we've reflected on, you've got above-ground stocks. This is the total gold which has ever been mined, pulled out of the earth, of about 174,000 tons. That's, in dollar terms today, the equivalent of about $7.4 trillion. Half of that, 50%, is in jewelry, 17% is official sector, or what they would call central bank holdings, and 20% is private investment. The interesting thing, okay, so there's another 13%, which is sort of a random mix-match of things, but that 20% of private holdings, private investment, exceeding the official sector, that displacement took place just a few years ago, with individuals now controlling the market far more than central bankers.
Just to put in perspective, Dave, okay, you said all the gold that has ever been mined that we know of is $7.4 trillion worth. Okay, that's an amazing figure when you figure that our deficit is over $17 trillion. So we couldn't pay the American debt off, even if we had all the gold in the world, and we don't.
Well, and to be fair, that's not all of the gold that's available for purchase at any price. You have to realize that much of the gold which has been purchased will never come back to the market at any price. And that's particularly in that 50% category. A lot of that is wealth worn. And so whether it's India or China or, frankly, you know, jewelry that I've bought my wife, not that it's on any kind of a comparable scale, but I think you do see sort of a permanent holding. And that's something that goes from one generation to the next. When a granddaughter inherits a gold ring from her grandmother, I mean, this is the kind kind of thing where it's an honor to own it. And it would be almost sacrilegious to go ahead and melt it down.
Right.
Somehow you would be offending the grandparent that had gifted you so generously. That's the notion of again, half of the gold stock is not even available, except and unless you are sort of the divorcee who wants to get rid of the wedding ring. Or obviously, there's instances in which the jewelry becomes expendable.
Well, and maybe we can discuss scrap gold, which is what you're talking about in that situation a little while later. But given this year, Dave, we've watched the United States move back into the stock market. We've watched people have unusual faith in a dollar that even the guy who was head of quantitative easing has come out and said, hey, you better not put too much credence on. But the Chinese support for the market, the Chinese have just been buying more and more and more as the United States has waned.
It's been absolutely critical, and prices would have been far worse this year had it not been for Chinese demand. We saw this primarily in the second quarter of this year. If you're looking at year-to-date numbers, we've seen a decline in demand in total of about 12%. That's in aggregate. You know, it includes a rip-roaring increase of jewelry demand by 20% and investment demand, which has fallen in half. It was primarily, again, in the second quarter because third quarter declines have only been about 4%. Central banks, they're still buying several hundred tons this year, with Turkey and Russia being sort of at the top of the list. And it's not as aggressive as 2012, the, again, official sector or central bank purchases, but still fairly impressive and well above the liquidations. Because remember, on a net basis, we were seeing liquidations as recently as 2009, and now we still have several hundred tons in net purchases.
Well, and I think it's interesting to note, Dave, we may be decreasing our buying here in America because we have more confidence in making money, say, in the stock market as a country, but the Chinese buy gold for a different reason. They're looking at America. We've had the reserve currency now for, you know, for half of a century, and they're looking at America, and they're buying gold for a completely different reason. They're looking at our labor market. They look at how we adjust for unemployment. They look at how the Federal Reserve is trying to print money to increase the employment rate. So what were the observations from the Chinese side?
Well, I think the simplest observation came on the plane ride over, sitting next to two folks who were just returning from the Los Angeles area and had been on vacation there. He works at a power plant just out of Shanghai, has been there all his life. And I told him that I was going to meet with a number of people in the gold industry from around the world. And he said, oh, gold, we love gold. And I said, well, what do you mean we? We as in you and your wife, or we the Chinese people? And he said, well, we the Chinese people. I said, tell me the primary reason why.
Yeah.
And without skipping a beat, he said, 10 years from now, my savings will not buy what they should if I just put my money in the bank. That's why Chinese people like gold. And I thought, you know, in a nutshell, he's understood the nature of inflation better than I think any American I've ever met. Because, you know, 1% per year, while it's a nuisance, it is not a dangerous thing to encounter. 1% inflation, 2% inflation, 3%, which is the current inflation rate in China right now, 3% with a 3.5% target. But he's basically saying, you take that 3.5% target over a 10-year period, and you have just devastated, compound negatively, your savings by 3.5% per year, and that's the PBOC's target? You've devastated your savings. He understands that 1 year does not a tragedy make, but 10 years, and you're so far behind the curve as a saver, you can never meet your financial objectives or goals in life.
Well, and I think of Americans thinking that they have free press and that we have much freer minds than they do in communist countries, but I hate to say it, Dave, that the people that I've learned more about America from are the people who have been through the propagandized media for so many years, the Russians, the Chinese. And these guys are looking back and they're going, can't you even see that they're misreporting the CPI?
There was a massive contrast between the folks that I met with and a number of precious metals analysts who work for major Wall Street banks, that's both European and U.S. banks, and their assumptions all tied to official U.S. government statistics. And it was interesting because one of the first Chinese economists to share his ideas, he started by saying, listen, if the labor market improves substantially, you'll see the U.S. unemployment rate increase.
That sounds counterintuitive. And he says if labor market substantially increases, unemployment rate would increase.
Well, then, and that's because you look at the labor participation rate, and it's been in decline. We now have the labor participation rate at levels we haven't seen since the 1970s. And if anyone's paying attention, not just to the 7.2, 7.3 number, if they're paying attention to how we compute that number, what you find is that we've seen shrinkage in the people who are in the labor force.
Sure, they fall off after a year anyway.
And that has improved the number significantly, far more than the addition of new jobs. They're keenly aware of this, And again, we're recalling that if you held the labor participation rate constant over the last 5 years, the unemployment number today would still be north of 10%. Hmm. So, I mean, what are we looking at? An improvement in the economy? Because I tell you what, the analysts who were negative on gold were so on the basis of a recovery in employment, and yet it was the Chinese who were saying, but we look at that employment number with a somewhat suspicious eye. And it was another Chinese metallist analyst from a very large Chinese bank, which started by discussing U.S. inflation and how, frankly, inadequate the CPI was as a measure of real inflation.
Let me just insert here. I mean, we just talked about employment, and now we're talking about inflation, which is monetary stability. So the two mandates of the Fed that we talked about with Andrew Huszar, we're talking employment being misrepresented. We're talking about CPI being misrepresented. What did he have to say?
Well, it was interesting because, again, you look at the U.S. and European precious metals analysts, and their core assumptions were low inflationary environment, economic recovery in the United States, improving labor market, all of these spell lower, significantly lower gold prices.
They were drinking the Western Kool-Aid,
And I think the Chinese are just happy to hear us spout that stuff because it provides an opportunity for them, and that's an opportunity they have been taking advantage of, and you can see it in the tonnage imports through Hong Kong. Well, back to the inflation issue. The discussion centered on how higher the rates of inflation are in developing countries. And one of the points suggested was that you're not really looking at an apples-to-apples comparison because the U.S. uses one methodology for calculating inflation, but every country uses its own unique methodology for counting inflation. It's not the same equation. And lo and behold, when you look at the BRIC countries, whether it's Brazil, Russia, India, China, or your other developing countries, less developed even than those four big ones, you see higher rates of inflation. But that is in part because they are not as practiced in the art of obfuscation, in the art of hiding real inflation.
Well, and we can hide real inflation to a degree, just like we can keep interest rates unusually low, because we are the reserve currency of the world. But, David, isn't the renminbi turning into a international currency far more than what it had been, say, 5 years ago?
An incredible improvement in cross-border use of the RMB. And this is where their currency is becoming much more important with their primary trade partners on a global basis, and even more powerfully right now on a regional basis. And you know, for them to really step into their own and have the RMB, the renminbi, become a significant force in the world monetary structure, you are looking at this sort of subtle accumulation of gold ounces by the PBOC. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But, you know, really the things that are helping the Chinese gold market mature, target setting and reaching their objectives, and an improvement in technology and trading, which they have moved leaps and bounds in a very short period of time. Two places come to mind, both the Shanghai Gold Exchange as well as the Shanghai Futures Exchange, a different exchange.
Well, and it's important to point out, I mean, gold is exchanged physically and it's valued physically in China, but we set the prices, even though we have 5%, 6% of the demand, we set the pricing of gold basically with our futures market here.
Because the volumes traded in futures contracts ultimately dwarf anything in the physical market today, 30 times at least, and in high trading volume days, you can have it dwarf by 100 times. In the Shanghai Gold Exchange, this is the physical market hub in China, and they currently work with 4 million individual investors, 7,000 institutions, and they continue to tailor products for further segmentation of the market. And again, physical market hub in contrast with the futures exchange also there in Shanghai. And this is your primary distribution to jewelers, and this is what's really intriguing to me. 14 different banks obviously primarily state-owned banks, with now over 100,000 branches distributing gold both in physical formats and via gold-backed savings and deposit accounts.
So don't tell me the Chinese don't love gold. I mean, 100,000 branches, and obviously people are buying and selling gold.
When I go into the local bank here in Durango, Colorado, I see posters which advertise the insultingly low interest rates offered on 1, 5, and 10-year bank CDs, right, certificates of confiscation, I mean deposit. We walked into a number of branch banks, both for the Agricultural Bank of China and the Industrial Commercial Bank of China, two of the largest banks in China, and in terms of rankings for international, you know, if you're looking at sort of the market caps of large banks in the world, that they rank up in the top 10. Their branch banks have posters with gold bars stacked on each other, and this is what you're putting your investments into. This is what you're putting your savings into.
They're not trying to earn interest right now. They're trying to accumulate preservation.
Right. Now, they can take delivery of their savings or deposit accounts denominated in gold, and they, when they're from a paycheck or whatnot, adding to those deposits, they can do it in as small a fraction as 1 gram of gold, or they can actually just buy and take physical delivery of gold. We'll talk about bar demand in for gold in just a minute, but you know, futures exchange, this is very different. The futures exchange,
this is the paper side of the market,
in Shanghai,
yeah,
will rank number 3 globally, with every expectation in the future to exceed NYMEX volumes and take out the number 2 position, that is NYMEX COMEX, and be that number 2 right behind London. This is what's intriguing. The U.S. and London, they're still determining the price, but will not do so forever. And the Chinese, it was very clear, in translation of course, that the goals and objectives there in China were to develop the infrastructure, the technology, and the trading capability to not just be price takers, but be the price makers in the gold market.
Well, let's put in perspective then, what percentage do they do now of what would be traded normally on our commodities exchanges here?
They're currently about a quarter of what COMEX trades in terms of gold, and in terms of silver trading, they actually exceed COMEX trading in silver. That's astounding for an exchange that didn't exist 10 years ago. By year-end 2014, they'll have 24-hour trading, and they're now in the process of developing an options market as well. They're very close to having 24-hour trading now, because this year they opened up another window from 9 p.m. till 2:30 a.m., and that now accounts for close to 50% of their volume. So they're seeing very active trading even through the evening session, and again, they're very close to having that 24-hour trading.
Well, in a way, they have to take the horse by the reins, because they are the primary market. I mean, haven't they even exceeded India's demand at this point?
They have. China exceeded Indian demand this year, and that's, again, sort of another category of displacement by the Chinese. The Chinese displaced Japan is the number 2 economy of the world here recently. Yes, they displaced India as the number 1 consumer of gold. And, you know, just one word on India, because there was some comment given in our conversations and discussions there. The rupee has been incredibly weak, and it's important to remember that when you price an asset in a weak currency, its price will be higher. So the Chinese market and the Indian market are both price-sensitive consumers. They're buying for gold, and if it's on sale, they buy more.
The lower it goes, the more they buy. That's opposite the West.
It very much is the opposite. And we didn't see as much Indian demand this year. I mean, it was still close to 1,000 tons. I think 832 was about the tonnage imported. And of course, that's with currency restrictions, or with import restrictions, as well as a very high import tax, with a combined duty and premium putting the price of gold in some instances as much as $200 above the spot price. So Indian demand, even with at times that $200 premium, was fairly robust. Although you could say it suffered as a consequence of gold in rupee terms being incredibly high. You see what I'm saying?
Well, and the other thing we have to take into account, I mean, we watched Pakistan's gold demand go up 830% over the last quarter. So some of this gold coming into India is not necessarily being measured. What we're talking about are official gold demand numbers, right?
Well, that's right, because when you raise taxes to the extent that they have and you begin to see physical premiums with that kind of a stretch, $100 to $200 an ounce, you've just written a business plan for black market imports into India.
Coming in from Pakistan.
Or
yeah,
anywhere
least.
Else. Yeah. Dubai, yeah. Pakistan, you name it. So demand has traditionally been in the form of jewelry. Now, as we mentioned, the savings programs and bar purchases are on the increase. In 2012, we saw demand for bars around 240 tons. Again, that's pretty significant. This year's bar demand will exceed that, coming in closer to 350 tons. That's according to the vice chairman at the China Gold Association.
And that gives us a picture of the type of buyer that's buying gold. A jewelry buyer is not buying bars.
Right. So investment demand is a new and growing segment in Asia and in China specifically.
You know, that brings up a point, talking about the West versus the East. The West really does, the ETF, the exchange-traded funds, really represent sort of a Western way of thinking. We're going to jump into something because it's going up, and we're going to jump right back out because it's going down. But demand changed with the Western world institutional investors selling not only gold, but actually a lot more ETF gold.
Well, and it's very critical to see that there was a trigger in the marketplace, which was in the futures market. These were naked contracts. In other words, no gold actually backing the transactions. Large volume, naked contract liquidations, which were the triggers, which then set off sort of an avalanche of selling amongst your institutional investors. These are your Western world institutional investors, Wall Street types, jumping out of investment in gold.
Right, which is to make money, not to preserve or do what the Chinese are trying to do.
Yeah, very much in contrast with, again, the physical consumer demand, which in the Eastern markets this year was 2,167 tons. Compare that with Western market, again, consumer demand in contrast with investor demand. Consumer demand in all of your Western markets, that includes Europe and the United States, 402 tons in contrast to Eastern of 2,167.
So about one-fifth.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. But again, there was a trigger in the futures market, followed through with the ETFs. And again, on the physical side, that's where there's been a tremendous amount of strength. Average monthly imports into Hong Kong have exceeded 100 tons.
Now, that's per month, 100 tons a month?
Yep. And the big change in 2013 was the Western investors seeing no need to hedge against sovereign default, because apparently there is no problems in Europe, and the U.S. has already solved its problems in terms of a long-term debt and structural issue there.
Or even a hedge against inflation. They're just talking right, like inflation doesn't exist.
Yep, or other various risks. Well, there's confidence. There's confidence in U.S. statistics. You know, and so we've had improved GDP numbers. We've had zero inflation. We've had improved housing numbers. We've had better labor statistics, all, of course, which are dependent on official information gathered by, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics and groups like that here in the U.S.
In other words, so say the people who benefit by you believing them.
Yeah, well, there are many here and in China which consider those numbers to be dubious. And so that's just to contrast, again, sort of the Wall Street party line. And very, very interesting. Every one of the precious metals analysts for your major Wall Street banks deferred 100% to the House economist. So they wouldn't say, my opinion on growth in the global economy, my opinion on U.S. domestic growth is. They would say, our economists believe, and therefore we see, and they would talk about gold in the context of something that was predetermined by the House economist's view. But that House economist's view, again, is dependent on what many in China and we here in House would view as a dubious set of statistics.
Well, David, in the years that I've done this with your family, you know, almost three decades, I tend to look mainly at investment demand and central bank demand. That's my interest. That, to me, shows the economic picture. But really, jewelry is still very dominant in the demand picture for gold, and that I don't want to neglect that.
Yeah, and if you want to look back at the last decade, so it's the 2003 to 2013. In 2003, Chinese and Indian jewelry demand was roughly 600 tons, and believe it or not, the U.S. and Europe were only slightly less than that. So we were kind of running neck and neck in that one category, jewelry demand. Now the U.S. and Europe is less than 200 tons. It's a two-thirds decline in U.S. and Europe jewelry demand. And China and India have nearly doubled to 1,000 or thereabouts combined. This is, again, just that jewelry demand segment. But again, we're seeing differences in terms of who's doing what in this space.
Well, and like I pointed out before, the difference also in the type of gold buyer who goes out and buys an ETF, he's just buying a piece of paper to play the price. When we sell ETF stocks, physical gold actually does come available. That's the whole backbone of an ETF, but it sounds like it's all going to China.
Well, and many are concerned that the ETFs have no gold in them. I would just offer as Exhibit A the 697 to 760 tons of gold, which was liquidated from ETFs by institutional investors broadcasters and physically flown to China and India. Mm. Not only did the gold exist, it does exist. It, to be able to come up with 760 tons of gold with the click of a mouse when the U.S. government can't come up with half of that amount in terms of the German gold requested by Germany earlier in the year and promised on a delivery basis over 7 years, who has it, who doesn't? I think that's very clear at this point.
Dave, if we were an eye in the sky, you know, when we go back and read history books, we're looking from centuries perspectives and we're saying, wow, look at the power shift that occurred, let's say, between, you know, the Netherlands and Spain and England. Those take a long time. But looking from a bird's eye view, this looks like a century's worth of power shift that's occurring in a matter of a couple of years.
I think this is one of the things that as I sat and discussed these issues with a number of experts in the field, I had chills run throughout my body on a number of occasions. You had institutional liquidations feeding Asian consumer demand, which is growing. And this is key because you're talking about a very sticky kind of environment. It's not gold that will come back to the market with higher prices. Mm. So yeah, well, further liquidations from ETFs, they could pressure gold prices lower, which in turn would stimulate Asian consumer demand where cheaper is better. But consider the return of investor demand.
Yeah, when it happens.
When it happens.
Because
it's
not if.
So maybe inflation expectations increase. Maybe tail risk or hedging against a black swan event returns as a priority. Or even concerns over geopolitical relations draw investors in the West back into gold. Remember that the tons which had been available via the ETFs are now off the market.
Some of it forever.
And so then again, sort of contrast what happens in a short period of time in terms of a turn in investor sentiment. Recall that after the collapse of Lehman, gold was up 22% in 20 days.
Mm.
You know, or the Greek government debt crisis in April of 2010. That drove gold in euro terms up 23%. Mm. Last but not least, we had the downgrade of U.S. debt in July of 2011. That was followed by 60 days later, a record gold price. So I guess what I'm saying is that events do matter, and investment demand, while it's negatively biased today, it can turn on a dime.
Sure. We've seen that not only in gold. We've seen it in stocks, currencies, what have you.
Yeah, and the market, in contrast with the 2007 to 2011 period, is not as well supplied with excess gold tonnage.
Mm.
So the next price rise will represent a supply squeeze never before witnessed, because you've got millions of investors who will be chasing the market, which is now driven by hundreds of millions of gold consumers in Asia.
Well, okay, lest we are saying that all of a sudden gold's just going to go up here in the next month. I've talked to a lot of clients who are, they're becoming weary with the price being down, Dave. And so give us the worst case scenario. Rather than us saying, hey, by December this thing's going to be, or January, let's not do that. Let's say, what's the worst case scenario?
Okay, worst case scenario is we have continued weakness in 2014 as you work off further ETF hot money. And by hot money, I'm saying people that really didn't understand the gold market to begin with, but they thought they should have an allocation in case the world falls apart. And so they bought an ETF, which probably wasn't the best way to get an insurance policy, but that's the way they did it because they could buy it today, sell it tomorrow with the click of a mouse. You've got those sort of hot money gold holders that could sell an additional 300, 400, 500 tons of gold. If you look at it this way, you've got a few strong hands in the hedge fund community, which have sold and sold out and may sell out their additional holdings. They've been replaced in the market by millions of consumers.
Over on China's side.
Actually, yeah. An even stronger and far less volatile base of gold holders. So ultimately, this is quite constructive for building a base of near permanent holders in the market. You see?
Well, and here's what's interesting. You're not making a prediction that 2014 that this will happen. You're just saying, worst case scenario, yeah, maybe there'll be more tonnage that will come into the market, but it ain't coming back.
It's not coming back, which sets the stage, I think, for sort of a 2015 to 2018 time frame in which we kind of scratch our heads and say, how does it move that fast again? And again, we will have forgotten that you can move 22% in 20 days following the Lehman collapse. Those kinds of things happen, and we can make up for lost territory very, very quickly in the gold market, particularly when you're talking about supply and demand dimensions, that you have inelastic supply. You have had an extreme deterioration in the number of new gold finds around the world. We're talking about 5 million ounce deposits or greater. You used to find 5 or 10 of those a year back in the 70s and 80s. In the last year, we found one. And if you look at the last 10 years, it's been in steep decline. It's not like we have a mining infrastructure which, on the basis of increasing demand, will somehow be able to come up with more product to meet it. That's, I think, where people don't realize how supply constrained the market is.
These mines are having to shutter their doors and their windows as well because they can't afford to open. But China, they're the largest producer at this point, and they're not selling a single ounce of what they produce to the rest of the world.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, we've changed a lot in the last 10 years. China's become the largest gold producer. They're also the largest gold consumer. 400 tons this year, up from 300 tons last year. 1,000 tons is what is needed to meet consumer demand in China. So you've got, again, 1,000 tons less the 400 which they produce. That is a 600-ton shortfall, which explains a good deal of the imports this year. However, the year-end totals were on track for 1,000 tons imported versus the 600 tons which they need to meet consumer demand. It suggests that the central bank may well be adding to stocks quietly, their own stocks, the PBOC stocks, under the cover of increased consumer demand.
Yeah, because if you look at the ETF, you were talking about the amounts coming out of ETFs. That's almost exactly what the deficit is that they need to make up as they're buying gold.
But we estimate that the central bank has doubled its holdings already since its last announcement in 2009 to an approximately 2,300 to 2,500 tons. That would be several hundred tons a year, but bought quietly as they've gone along. They will likely exceed the German holdings of 3,390 tons before publicly announcing again. Again, think of that notion of displacing. And they are, in this instance, when they announce and come above that 3,390-ton level that the Germans hold, they will have displaced everyone on the list. This is official central bank gold holders, with the exception of the United States. They will rank number two in the world. And remember, this is what legitimizes a currency.
Well, and I was just thinking this. I was thinking going back to the 1970s when people were talking about the Trilateral Commission and redistributing the wealth. You know, if you think about it, Dave, we're the number one gold holder, supposedly. I mean, we're assuming Fort Knox has what they say that they have, so 8,200 tons. Germany right now, which really you have to say is the financial center of the European region and has been for a long time, is the second largest holder of gold. If China comes in and displaces Germany, I think what we're seeing is we are seeing that whether it's trilateral or whether it's a redistribution of wealth, we are seeing the power complex of the world truly change, because your dad was right. He who owns the gold makes the rules.
You know, they're jockeying for a position on the world stage, the world monetary stage, and it's gold backing which adds weight to the equation. You know, just for frame of reference, that 1,000 tons we mentioned as the 2013 imports. Compare that to current mine supply. It's basically half of all current gold production. Okay? That's going into India. Half of all new mine production is going to China. That doesn't include India. They're almost the other half of new mine supply. The only thing that's making up the difference is scrap gold. And this is where I think you look at demand in China. In our view, it will continue to increase.
One of the goals, Dave, even though it's still murky what they came up with, but one of the goals of the third plenum in China is an increase in income. Now, to put in perspective the income here in America versus the income in China, we're talking about this incredible demand, but isn't the per capita GDP in China less than $8,000 U.S. dollars a year?
Well, and this is what's intriguing to me. Many Western analysts see, you know, not only has China displaced Japan as the number two economy, they are now the number two economy. Japan's number three. You have the U.S. in the sights. And many of these analysts think that by 2020, the Chinese economy could be larger than the U.S. economy. GDP per capita in China is $7,958. That's one-fifth of the U.S. on a per capita basis. And it's assumed that a marginal increase to between $8,000 and $8,500, again, this is per capita GDP, that is sufficient to drive gold demand in China significantly higher.
Because they may be savings dollars.
These are extra dollars. This is a critical point, particularly when you consider the deliberate effort to increase the household income share of GDP in China. You're driving consumer choices and a consumer economy. That is the goal of the third plenum. That is the goal of the five-year plan, which was announced last March, or March a year ago, and gold is in the mix.
Well, and let's just look at how the incomes have risen so far, just in the last 4 or 5 years.
Between 2008 and 2012, rural incomes rose 70%. The currency has been appreciating, which obviously empowers purchasing power for anyone with any money coming in, and wages across the manufacturing complex have risen at double-digit rates for several years in a row. Again, this is all empowering a consumer. Know your audience here. And if you know your audience, you can see why gold is so much in the mix and why demand has been increasing.
Well, and we mentioned before, Dave, we're not earning interest here on our CDs, but they're not earning interest over there either. You know, and there, remember the Summers Barsky that you bring up all the time. If interest rates are high enough, people will move away from gold to get those interest rates, but they're very low in China.
And it's not just a function of high rates. It's a function of real rates, which factors in not only inflation, but taxes. Mm. So the Chinese real rate, that is net of inflation, they were deeply negative by about 3% 2010 to 2011, and now again, here in 2013, are slipping into negative territory again. So that investor component, we talked about the 240 tons of gold increasing to 350 tons from last year to this year. That's bar demand in China. Why is it increasing? Why is there an investor segment that's looking more at gold? Well, it's kind of obvious. For the same reasons that anyone else in the world does. If you're looking at CDs as certificates of confiscation, if you're looking at government bonds as certificates of confiscation, rather than a deposit which will maintain wealth and keep it safe, gold becomes a default, according to the Summers Barsky thesis.
Well, the only way, David, we can look forward, if we look forward in 5-year, 10-year, decade types of periods, is to actually go back and look at history, because we don't know the future without the memory of the past. And the beauty of working for the McIlvaney family is there is a memory of the past just by the 4 decades you all have been in business. And so let's go back to the 1970s when your dad saw that the decline of the dollar was going to be a real issue, started a gold firm when gold was still illegal to own. We don't have to go into that because there were ways of actually buying gold that back then. But what forethought, Dave? He started a firm when gold was $35 or $40 an ounce, and it rose in the 1970s to over $800, but that certainly was not without declines on the way up.
And there were macroeconomic factors in the late 60s which were still in place all throughout the 1970s, in spite of the ebbs and flows of the price. And I think this is very important to realize that the declines in the 1970s, you had a first decline of 14%.
Right.
Your next decline was 29%. Your next decline was 28%.
Now, there were huge rises between these declines.
Oh, of course, but your next decline was 47%. Now, granted, we started at 35. As you said, we ended at 875, but the next decline was 11%. The next decline was 12%. The next decline was 20, 17, and finally a 43% decline. Okay. And gold rose from 35 to 875. The macroeconomic drivers did not change. The context did not change. The price trajectory did not change. But we had the volatility, the ebbs and flows, which for anyone looking at that price action would say, I can't stand it.
Well,
it's far too painful. I just don't believe.
Even your dad will tell the story that 75, 76, I can't remember exactly the year, but he hiked up to the top of a mountain in Aspen because he was soul searching himself. This was a gold bug of gold bugs who's going, wait, gold's down 47%. Am I wrong?
Well, what's interesting is that was the fourth decline out of 9 declines in the total span of the bull market. Okay. And the declines in this bull market, we've had a 22%, a 15%, a 29%. The fourth decline is right now, and it's been as great as 34%. Nothing as bad as what we had in the 70s.
Yeah.
And we have yet to go the full trajectory of the bull market as we had in the 70s. Yes, we've gone from 272 to 1250. I guess the bottom line here is the corrections are normal.
Right.
What's interesting is that the dialogue around the corrections always changes, and it's particularly with your Wall Street firms.
Bloomberg,
I was fascinated.
Those guys, yeah.
I got the last question in amongst these groups of industry leaders in Shanghai, and I asked the question to the analyst at Société Générale, who wrote the report the same week that was released, the short recommendation by Goldman Sachs.
This is the Western mindset analyst.
Yes, correct. But this particular analyst from Société Générale, a French bank, he wrote a report saying, yes, we expect gold to go down. We would suggest you shorting gold. We think it's going to 800. We think it's going to much lower. That's what he wrote the week that Goldman shorted in April of 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I simply asked him, Mr. Bahar, what were your price projections between 2000 and 2002? Right now, your price projections are very negative. The price is trending lower, and your price projections are lower. What were your price projections in 2000 and 2002? To which his response was, flat to going nowhere. It had been 300 for two decades. Why should it ever do anything more than what it's been doing? And lo and behold, and I asked him secondarily, what were your price projections in 2009 and 2010? His response was significantly higher because that's the direction the market was trending. And I guess the point was they don't have a clue. They don't have a clue. All they're doing is extrapolating off of a chart trend line. Not only did they not see the bull market coming, but they assumed that from higher prices it would only go higher, and now with lower prices it will only go lower. The point being that these corrections are normal, and all they can do is try to wrap their minds around it and gather information to support the directional trend in the market at the time. Well, they're not giving us any insight into the future.
Well, and you're his son, so I won't have to tell you the rest of the story, but the listener needs to understand that Don, when he was sitting on top of that mountain in Aspen, realized that not one fundamental thing had changed. It had nothing to do with the trend that he had recognized, like these analysts from, you know, Societe Generale. He understood why he was buying gold, just like the Chinese understand why they're buying gold. David, he came back down the hill inspired, even though the price was still down just as it was
before. 47%!
He called a number of friends and he said, guess what? I would have been the last guy out because I'm a gold bug, but we have reached the bottom because I was considering getting out.
And then that was the fall of 1976.
And that was the bottom before it went up eightfold.
Well, very interestingly, from January of 2003 to the present, we've seen gold and silver diverge in price from the equities market. And, you know, up to that point, we had had the risk on, risk off. That was the standard conversation piece. Right. And it was sort of the inexplicable market relationship, because up to that point, it was assumed, again, before the risk on, risk off language was applied, that gold was non-correlated to stocks.
Sure.
Well, good news. We've regained the non-correlated relationship here in 2013. Even if it is in the context of lower prices, we're back to a normal relationship.
Right.
Now, I asked the question of the UBS analyst recently, what happens if equities fall 20 to 30%? And the answer, of course, was we'd have to raise our price projections on gold. I think the merit of 2013, yes, we've gone back to the non-correlated relationship between gold and the equities market. We do see some weakness in the equities market moving forward. And whether that is a 2014 first quarter, second quarter, third quarter, do we have a crystal ball? No, admittedly. But we do see that the fundamentals are still in place for a strong finish to a bull market. And if you appreciated the kinds of gains that you saw between 2000 and 2011, you might want to stick around, because the way this finishes will be very similar.
So, David, we've talked about fundamentals, we've talked about market direction, but lower prices are lower prices. And so what actually would be the cure for lower prices?
The cure for lower prices is lower prices. We've got that. And believe it or not, that's what sets the stage for the next rise in price.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.